apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed, and it must have been a rugged fight to get it. We can look on down the coast now and see this flat part of the beach, which joins the water, going all the way down to the lower beach, which is marked for us by columns of white smoke which are rising from it. And further up at the...
That's the sound of the D-Day landing in June 6, 1944, when the Allies, so the Americans, the British, Canadians, Australians involved as well, stormed the beaches of Normandy in France and began the invasion of what they called Fortress Europe, which was the Western Europe that was taken over by the Nazis. Whenever you hear anything about D-Day these days, it's covered with this sort of gauzy glow of nostalgia. And I think in part it's because, I mean, there's natural reasons, it's historical, but it's also this sort of pining for when things were clear, as the cause of democracy in the U.S. is under such strain today, and distinctions are unclear about who stands for what and the direction of the country. When you look back to the events of 1944, it's very clear where the country stood. In the recent anniversary, I found myself listening to some of this audio as well, because now with YouTube, you can find some really unusual and interesting little curious elements of the event. And I found the CBS audio recording from the wee hours of June 6, 1944, when the news just started to emerge. And so this was at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and they're broadcasting on national radio saying we're getting early reports. And the early reports were actually coming not from the Allied sources, but from the Nazis, who were putting it out on their radio system saying that an invasion was taking place. The Allies were keeping quiet to keep the Nazis guessing. But what I found that is a remarkable little element in the broadcast is a segment by a military analyst, a former major from the U.S. Army, named George Fielding Elliott. And he goes into great detail about the essential detailing, the fairness under which the generals were selected who are going to lead these troops into battle. And you have to imagine that in some ways he's trying to reassure the parents and the families as they listen to the news of the D-Day unfolding. But it also says a lot about the nature of American democracy at the time, that they would go to such lengths and such detail to explain the fairness of the system. This is something that I think is forgotten when we look back at some of the gauzier retellings of the events of World War II, that the culture of democracy was incredibly strong at that time. I mean, the country had endured 10 years of the Depression. There was inequality in every direction. The government, the U.S. government, had taken a very interventionist approach under President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal Democrats. But still, inequality was a grinding reality for many Americans. And so when the war came along and the idea of fighting for democracy, it had to be democracy at home first before it was democracy abroad. And so I've pulled out this one little snippet that runs about 5 minutes, and I think it's really worth just listening to what George Fielding Elliott has to say.
There is no use minimizing the stern and savage character of the fighting that lies ahead of our armies and their allies before they can hope to overcome the resistance of the German forces. The Germans are at bay. They are fighting for the last hope which remains for them, the hope of pushing back our invasion of Western Europe into the sea and then turning in full strength to check the coming Russian onslaught. It is not a very bright hope, but it is the only hope they have, and they will not give it up easily. There is one comforting thought which can sustain us as the battle is joined, and that is the fact that the present American army is the most capably commanded army which the United States has ever placed in the field at the outset of a war. And this is the real beginning of this war as far as large-scale land operations are concerned. Anyone who has ever read our military history will recall the cruel price which has been paid in the blood of our young men in order to prove the incapacity of political generals, or of superannuated generals, or of just plain stupid generals in all our preceding wars. Even in the war of 1917-18, when things were a lot better than they were in the Revolution, or in 1812, or in the Civil War or the Spanish War, there still had to be a considerable process of testing, of trial and error and elimination, before some of the incapable general officers of that time were gotten rid of. In this war, matters are very different.
I just want to point out here that these comments that are broadcast on American radio to the public by a military analyst are being broadcast at the very moment that bullets are flying across the coast of Normandy as troops are being moved onto land. So Allied troops are being moved onto land with their material to begin this offensive to liberate Europe from the Nazis. But the message that was broadcast was seen as urgent enough that the public needed to know that the system that these soldiers were fighting both for and under was just. It was a system where those who were leading because they were qualified, because they were tested, and not because they were a part of a comfortable elite that always ends up on top.
I don't mean to say that all our general officers are perfect, or even that all of them are, in all respects, admirable leaders. But as a whole, they represent a far higher average of leadership and all-round military capability than the generals of any of our other wars at the beginning of the first major campaign. This is because they are picked men, because there has been applied to them, not on the battlefield, not at the price of blood, but beforehand, in training and in maneuver areas, a process of test and strain and of ruthless weeding out of the unfit, a process which in all our other wars had to wait for the actual fighting to begin. And this process has also been applied to junior officers by the simple means of insisting that generals should see to it that their juniors were efficient or cease to be generals on active service. Every American general who now commands a division, a corps, or an army of American troops has been put through this hard and unforgiving mill of trial. Those who have failed in any degree have been relegated to non-combat duties or to the retired list. And the higher the rank and responsibility, the more severe the test, the more exacting the requirements. Of course, this process is not 100% proof against error. Nothing can be in such matters as war leadership, save the actual test of war itself. But it goes a long way, this process, toward eliminating the unfit before they get to the point where their unfitness can cost the lives of our young soldiers. Some, no doubt, will yet remain to be weeded out. But these will not be many, for most of those whose failings have been in any way demonstrated have been weeded out already. For this stern but highly necessary elimination of incapable leaders, the fathers and mothers and wives and sweethearts of the country have to thank the Chief of Staff of the Army, General George Marshall. Ever since he took over the duty as Chief of Staff, he has set himself determinedly to get rid of that class of high-ranking officers who always in time of peace seems to climb slowly up the ladder of seniority, and then when war comes, block the promotion of better men to the posts they are no longer capable of holding. General Marshall looked back on our past record, and he resolved that if war came in his time, he would not repeat that error at any rate.
Contrast that with what you hear about inequality in America today, inequality in countries like the UK and even Australia. The sort of disengagement about the bigger issues of fairness in society. And also think about the effect that our all-volunteer militaries have these days, where they wear the weight of the conflicts that they're in on their own shoulders sort of silently when they come back to their home countries. This was very much not the case post-World War II, where it was this massive shared experience. Instead, today, we have veterans that come back from these wars, and they have to wear the wounds quietly on their own. There's no sense of shared burden with them. So when we see the iconic footage of the landing at Normandy and D-Day and everything that is associated with that, it's good to remember that this is what democracy is about. that fairness of the system is what democracy is about. And that is how people are motivated to support democracy. And it's a virtuous cycle. When you can see that fairness and you can see that justice and that just system working, then the people will naturally support it. And when it comes to competition with other states that have very different political values, democracy is stronger to compete against those states when it is internally strengthened by a system that people can believe in.